The following teaching is part 13 in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
Let me just tell you where we've been on this first question about those who have never heard, or rather how Christ can be the only way to God. But what we've done so far is this. We talked about how Christianity, we said it's either narrow or it's not. If it's not narrow, the problem there we have is that it would conflict with the very clear, exclusive claims of Christ. And I gave a number of those claims that he has made in the Synoptics and in the Gospels, the Gospel of John. And we also saw that the unique claims that he had were claims that referred to his direct claims and his indirect claims. Some direct claims that he made about things that he uniquely fulfilled, being the I Am, the God-man, the indirect claims to be able to have the power to forgive sins, his indirect claim, which is an indirect claim to being God, because only God can forgive sins of other people that were not committed against ourselves. Strong claims about his miraculous ministry that were authenticated by the various proofs, many convincing proofs that he gave. Claims about the resurrection, which were also fulfilled. Claims to be the embodiment of the historical Old Testament messianic prophets, all those that spoke about him, all these texts from Genesis, Moses, all the way through to the writings and the prophets, all of these, he said, bear witness of me. He said that his life was one that was marked by sinlessness. Which of you convicts me of any sin? He had authority that he claimed was given to him uniquely by the Father, and he said, to hear me is to hear my Father. To see me is to see the Father. To believe in me is to believe in the Father. To deny or reject me is to reject my Father. To honor me is to honor my Father. And he demanded the same kind of obedience and faith, that they would honor the Son even as they honor the Father. Now, that word honor is a word that has to do with more like reverence or worship. The implications are very astounding. When Thomas, we saw last time we were together, made the claim, my Lord and my God, if he was not, and accepted that worship, it would have been blasphemous. So that very kind of claim that he made then, and the fact that he accepted worship, and all these things we saw sets him apart, and we saw that he had convincing claims and credentials that backed up those claims. So then we moved on to this other issue as well, and we talked about the alternatives, apart from Christ, would reduce to hopeless systems of human effort. So we were talking about this whole idea. We're going to develop that a little bit more when we talk about one of the later issues, which is about the question of good works. Can good works really get us into a right relationship with God? And we'll be going to be talking about how the vision of Christianity is unique. It's not so much a religion, we've said, but it's a relationship with a person. You're not merely believing in a set of prop principles, but you're putting your trust in a person. That's why intellectual assent is not enough. It must be a personal reception. How do you trust a person? You entrust yourself into their care, and that has to do then with really embracing him as a person. Now, we said if Christianity is, quote, narrow, there are assumptions that people make that would make that appear to be wrong. And we said one of those false assumptions was that sincerity makes a thing true. That's not the case, as we have seen again and again. We saw as well that whether you're sincere about it, you can be sincerely wrong. We also saw as well that the assumption that belief makes something true or false, it's not a question of whether a thing is true or false, is determined by how much you believe. You can believe all sorts of things that aren't true, as people have done throughout the centuries. It's a question of, is there any good reason to think that it's true or false? And also we saw that there's another false assumption, that exclusiveness, if it's exclusive, it must be wrong. And this is an idea we've picked up, and we've redefined the word tolerance, as we've saw before. Tolerance, by the way, even the way we use it in colloquial language, when you say, let's say you went to a restaurant, and you asked somebody, how did you like the meal? And the person says, I tolerated it. You immediately see what the real meaning is. It doesn't mean that I enjoyed it. It means I put up with it. You see now? So tolerance, in its traditional term, meant to not necessarily agree with or affirm, but in the case of relationships with people, to still care for them and love them even when you disagree. And that disagreement doesn't mean a rejection of the person. But in our culture, we've redefined the word to mean that you tolerate something. It means you are affirming it wholeheartedly, even if you disagree. And I'm suggesting here that you can disagree with a person and still not reject them. Although our world is now more and more telling us you can't do that, I'm suggesting that that's not the case, that you can agree to disagree, but that doesn't mean that you're rejecting the person. If you and what the, what we have is this mindset that all truth is up, it's it really all up for grabs. There's a new book that came out that is written by Paul Copan, C-O-P-A-N, and it's called True for You But Not for Me, and it's a fairly helpful overview of a lot of these tough questions that people ask. It's a good supplement as well to my book, I'm Glad You Asked. It deals with some of the basic questions you're going to hear more and more frequently. That's true for you but not for me. In other words, that can be true. Truth is up for grabs. So many people disagree. Relativism must be true. You're just using Western logic. Who are you to judge others? And Christians are intolerant of other viewpoints. He goes on to say that every view, by its nature, cannot tolerate the other views in the sense of saying that they're all equally right. And that it's not just Christianity that's, quote, exclusive. If the things disagree, the law of non-contradiction we saw last week, if we said, remember we used the analogy about poodles? And we said that one person says all dogs shed hair, someone else says poodles don't shed hair. Now, there's only a couple ways around that deal. You can say that poodles aren't dogs, and then we can both agree. Or if we say poodles are dogs, and you can't have it both ways. You see where we're going with that. So you can't say that's true for you, but not for me. It has nothing to do with you and me. It has to do with whether the thing out there is true or not. That's what I'm suggesting here. It's not a question of just an opinion. He talks about a number of areas, but it's well worth a look. So we're suggesting here as well that looking at the various religions, and we looked at five of them. We looked at Christianity, we looked at Judaism, we looked at Buddhism, we looked at Islam, we looked as well, what was the fifth one, at Hinduism. And at those five, we saw that they radically disagree on their view of God. In fact, they disagree within themselves, because as we saw, let's take various forms of Hinduism. There are philosophical Hindus who really have a monistic or pantheistic view. There are practical Hindus, the vast mass of people in India, for example, who aren't monists, but rather are polytheists. Now, they both can't be right in the same way and in the same sense, if you see where I'm going with that. There are some forms of Buddhism that are atheistic. Some forms of Buddhism that have a God in there, and sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's impersonal. And so I'm saying that you can't have it both ways. They disagree even with them themselves. Their view of God is different, their view of human nature is different, their view of human destiny is different, and their view of salvation is different. And they could all be wrong, but they can't all be right. That's what I'm suggesting here. So as I said before, when Muhammad says that Christ is not the way, but he is a great prophet, but he is not what you Christians would say that he is, that he is not the way, the truth, and the life, then you can say that, or a person can say that Jesus is, in fact, the way, the truth, and the life, but you can't be both right, if you see where I'm going with this. So you have a very, very real issue that because they disagree, always, in one way or another, are narrow because they cannot accept them each other. This is very true in the academic community, where the most intolerant forms of discourse, social discourse, are forms that promote tolerance and are intolerant of those who do not promote tolerance. This is a major deal going on in seminaries and all sorts of things. They are as intolerant and as belittling of people who do not agree with their position as any fundamentalist would ever have been about people who don't agree with their positions. Do you see where I'm going with that? You can't play it both ways there. If you're truly tolerant, then you'd also be willing to go along with people who are, quote, intolerant by your definition. I'm just sort of summarizing. Let's pick up, and then what we did is, at the end, we looked at the unique claims of Christ and his unique credentials. And these are numerous, and we talked about how he claimed to have the power to forgive sins, to be sinless, to fulfill Old Testament prophecies, that he would rise from the dead, that he would come again and judge the world. That's a pretty big claim, again, that all people would be, their judgment would be based upon him. So the nature of this is always the same. that they could all be wrong, but they can't all be right. And then one has to deal with the issues. And one has to deal with the issue of who makes this sort of thing up. Let me read something from Renovare, Richard Foster. Some of you know him from having written a book that is called Celebration of Discipline. He also wrote another book called The Spirit of the... No, that was... He also wrote another book called Prayer, Finding the Heart's True Desire, and some other books as well that are very helpful. He makes a comment in this little Perspective magazine here that the true exclusivity of the gospel. He says, the uniqueness of Christ, this exclusivity, which says that Jesus is the only way of salvation, does not set well with modern sensibilities. People today wish every way to be valid, every belief to be true, every sincere person to be right. Well, we do. Who wants to? But the fact is, again, we live in an age, as he's saying, where there is no truth or no absolute. Everything is up for grabs. But the truth be told, he says, we're not in a position to set the rules in these matters. And this is something you need to keep reminding yourself. This isn't something that we're making up. You have to decide whether the gospel accounts are right or wrong. But it's not like we're making the call and saying that this is the way it is. If I'm just taking what Jesus says in those gospel narratives seriously, and these are the implications of it. So Foster goes on to say, the law of non-contradiction, the reality that a thing cannot both be and not be at the same time, flies in our face every time we try to have things some way other than the way they are. And we know, take any example from your life that doesn't have to do with God and religion. Bring it down to the earthly plane and you'll see it's true. I use the example of dogs. Give me something else, something simple. One person can say A and one person can say B and they both can't be right. Something practical. Take something at your work, okay? I'll give you an example. Somebody from your company is accused of being an embezzler. They've been accused of embezzling $5,000 from the company funds. The person says, I didn't do it. Somebody else says he did. Can they both be right? You with me? I mean, this isn't complex stuff. It's real simple. I'm bottom lining it here. What is so painfully obvious to us on the earthly plane somehow is elevated to being some abstract mystery when it comes to spiritual things. But nobody lives that way on the course of their day. I'm just suggesting here that we have two sets of rules that I don't know where they came from, but we somehow throw all logic to the winds when it comes to ultimate reality. But we can't be this way. Tomatoes are either a fruit or a vegetable, yeah. Right? Or peanuts. Same deal there. Are they nuts? The claim is that aren't they legumes? They're not nuts, therefore. Okay, you can't have it both ways unless you want to redefine nuts to be anything you want them to be. You see, we're playing by two sets of rules. What you do here, when you come down to that example, there's sometimes the equivocation that takes place. Sometimes a person means something this, and the other person means that, and they're at loggerheads. What the law of non-contradiction says is that the two things cannot be true at the same time and in the same sense. You see, so that's what this says. In the same time and in the same sense. So clearly, there's a lot of truth in other religions. You need to understand that. Sometimes people go too far and throw out the baby with the bathwater. There are rich insights in other religions. In fact, they have pretty much the same moral codes. This should not be a surprise because general revelation, according to Romans 1, tells us that you'd expect people to have a sense in Romans 2 as well with their conscience about what's right and wrong. And there's a generally agreed moral code. C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, talks about this in great detail. There he calls it the Tao, T-A-O. And this Tao he uses as a term to describe the fact that whether you're looking at Islam, Confucianism, whether you're looking at Egyptian law codes, Babylonian, the Code of Hammurabi, whether it's Chinese, you find an incredible moral agreement across cultures and times, a transtemporal and transcultural basic agreement about what's right and what's wrong. And they all agree that treachery and murder and kidnapping and betrayal and so on and so forth are wrong. You see where I'm going with that? And Lewis is basically saying that indicates something that we all know. We all have a sense. And frankly, we live this way. And this is why anything that you call blameworthy tells you that you're really appealing to some standard, and things that you call praiseworthy are appealing to some standard, you see? And everybody, I don't care whether they're an atheist or a theist, has some things that are blameworthy and some things that are praiseworthy in their thinking. You don't run into people who basically say, I think it's a good thing and I'm going to do my own thing. I like really injuring babies. I really like torturing kids. So there's something about that we all know there's something wrong with that. And we realize then when a person would make such an affirmation that there's a psychopath and that we're dealing with a person who is pathological in the sense that they do not share in the common understanding of what's right and wrong. And we live this way in the practical level, but when we project it with morality as well as truth on the large level, we suddenly go off and become irrational again. That's what I'm suggesting. So the law of non-contradiction says in the same time and in the same sense. That's what that means. Foster goes on to say, if Jesus is the way, then those who are not in his way are not in the way. Jesus lived, died, rose, and now extends to us, his disciples, the same life and power that he knew when he was among us in the flesh, that is his way. He goes on to say, the disciple of Jesus actually has a transforming relationship with God, which those who are not his disciples simply do not have. This is the true exclusivity of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The reality of people who have turned from darkness to light, turned from fornication and impurity and licentiousness and idolatry and sorcery and enmities and strife and jealousy and anger and quarrels and dissensions and factions and envy and drunkenness and carousing, and turned, by the way, that's just a litany from Galatians 5, and they've turned instead to love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and generosity, faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. It is an exclusivity of those who are truly living and walking in holiness and power of Jesus Christ. So when it comes down to it, we're claiming that this is the way by which the human life is transformed. And there is no other way, there's no other power that's capable of taking people and changing them in that kind of way. That there is that it's not only that you're having a belief system, but it's who you believe in and what that produces in your very life. And so those are some of the issues. But let's pick up and continue from there. I want to move into a couple of second issues, implications. One has to do with the Jew. And the reason why I want to do that is because it's a question that often surfaces in connection with this issue. In the early church, as you well know, the problem facing believers at the very beginning of the church was not how a Jew could become a Christian, but how a Gentile could become a Christian. That was the real rub. In fact, when word got out that this Roman centurion Cornelius came to faith in Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah, what did they say? What did the believers say? The Jewish believers. They said, this can't be. How can a Gentile become a Christian? Interesting, isn't it, how that was? Remember, who wrote the New Testament? Everybody except Luke was a Jew. Everybody. Who was Jesus? He was Jewish. That's why most representations of Jesus really don't look really what he would have looked like. He would look more like a Semite. He would have a Semitic appearance. He wouldn't look like a Teutonic, somebody from Germany or whatever. I remember still when I was a kid, and they had a picture of Jesus, and it looked like some German in the 19th century there. And I was, what is he doing there with the long hair? And he looked somewhat feminine to me as well. And, you know, I said, man, something's not right with this picture here. You have a very different vision, a very different image, though understand the Gospels are real deliberate about not giving one physical description of Jesus. Very interesting. The only description you've got at all of him is by implication from Isaiah 53, where it says, and elsewhere, where they plucked out his beard. The New Testament, you know, that it talks about that idea, and that he has no stately form or majesty that we should be attracted to him. That's about the closest you get. And there's a good reason for that, because you see, Jesus Christ was the man for all men, the man for all people. And therefore, he transcends cultures and race and gender. He transcends all those because he, in fact, being the God-man, makes it possible for all people to come into the Father's household. And that is a powerful picture. So the question, what are you going to do with these Gentiles? Paul says in Philippians 3 how he needed Jesus for salvation, even though he himself was the epitome of a great Jew. He talks about, I was a law keeper, I was a Pharisee of Pharisees, I was even so zealous that I went and persecuted these crazy people who were believing in some false Messiah. Remember that? And he says, I understood, though, that it was a righteousness by means of keeping the law, wasn't going to cut it, but rather it had to be righteousness by trusting in Jesus. That's the only hope that I would have. Paul says in Romans 1:16, I am not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. And then what does it say? To the Jew first and also to the Greek. You see that idea? To the Jew first and then to the Greek. All people. Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free man, there is neither male nor female, you're all one in Christ Jesus. Now, it's a very powerful, by the way, real countercultural vision. The things that divide us even today are overcome in the gospel. That he makes a broad road for all who would be willing to see him. He opens it up and takes all the things, the barriers that we erect, and removes them and says, in God, in Christ Jesus, you have a welcome to the Father's family. All are welcome. Whosoever will may come in. That's an incredible concept in an exclusivistic society. So we see this, though, but clearly, though, he, according to Ephesians 2, he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one, speaking of Jew and Gentile, broke down the barrier of the dividing wall. And in 1 Timothy 2:5, there's one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. So there are not a series of mediators, but there is one mediator. It's a verse you ought to know, 1 Timothy 2:5. It's one that you ought to keep in your mind's eye, because Paul there makes it clear, there's not several mediators, there's one. And the reason for this, of course, is very obvious, and we've talked about this before, is because it required the God-man to be the mediator. So that being the God-man, when he reaches down, what he does is takes on humanity, and he takes humanity and raises humanity up into God. But we don't become gods, but he raises himself up and he himself becomes the God-man. And in the God-man now, we can have a relationship with the Father. Where before, the Father was so transcendent, so holy, so awesome, that we couldn't even hope to reach him. And we're going to see this again, how all the human efforts, the attempts for us to reach God, the best you're going to do is about to get that high. Most of us will be little dots along here. This might be the most righteous person by a human standard who ever walked. So this might be me here, a little dot over here. One of you might be a far more noble person, but you see, relative. You know, so here's a guy who says, boy, if God's fair, you'll let me in. Okay, what is he comparing himself to? If he's fair, this thing's a mile high on the standard. If I use this scale, this would be a mile up. Now how are we doing? And our problem is we compare with each other. The God-man only, you see, if he was not a man, he couldn't have died. And if he wasn't of God, his death would have only been merely an example or a martyrdom, but it would not have been redemptive. He had to be fully God and fully man. And in being so then, the God-man, he becomes the mediator between us and the Father, so that he becomes the way to the Father. Strong words that he's made again and again. I think I made this quote before, but let me give it to you again. Here's another one you ought to keep in mind, Matthew 11. Matthew 11, the part you like the most, that I like so much, is, come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. By the way, it doesn't say take the law upon you, take my yoke. Learn, and by the way, learn from whom? Don't learn from something else, learn from me. So he is saying true discipleship is the knowledge of himself. Understand, in all the Gospels, everything Jesus talks about is about himself. Very self-referential here. He's not saying, learn this system, learn these teachings, do that, do the other. No, come and know me. The way of life is me. He says, for I am gentle and humble in heart. Now, by the way, who of us in this room could say that without guffaws from other people? I mean, if you really stop and think about it, it's almost preposterous for one of you to say, I'm gentle and humble in heart. We'd almost immediately say, there's something wrong with that. But somehow he can say it and get away with it, yet he's the most powerful personality who ever lived. How can this be? Somehow you know that what he says is true, and yet there's also an awesome power under control. That's what humility is power under control. And what we see here is, I am gentle and humble in heart, and what does he offer? You shall find rest for your souls. And that's what you and I desperately need in this world of weariness. and travail and pain. The world that's not as it was meant to be. You need rest for your soul. Soul rest. You need to have, in a world of turmoil and outward confusion, you need inner tranquility and peace. You need rest. And Jesus says, you come to learn from me and you will find rest for your souls. But then he goes on to say, for my yoke is easy. My burden is light. Unlike that of the Pharisees. But I want you to notice what he said in the verse just before those three verses, Matthew 11, 28 through 30. He says this strong word in verse 27. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father. Nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. I'd say that's a strong claim. I'll leave it to you to think about the implications of that claim. They're pretty powerful, pretty awesome. Let's continue on. Suggesting here, then, that the Jew, like anyone else, has to deal with the problem of sin, and the standard is set by God's perfection, and it's found in Isaiah. Isaiah 53, which talks about how we missed it. All of us, like sheep, have done what? What a great image. That's maybe the clearest image of human nature. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned where? His own way. So there's only two options in the end in this world. Either God's way or your way. And when Adam said, not your will but mine be done, he turned the garden into a desert ultimately. In other words, he turned this world, which was a paradise, into a desert spiritually. And when the second Adam said, not my will but thine be done, he turned that garden as to the place as the gateway of heaven, the entry to the gateway of heaven. He opened it up. What I'm saying then is that the second Adam has undone the work of the first Adam by saying, not my will but thine be done. Each of us has turned to his own way. There's a stubbornness about us, is there not? Some of us are more stubborn than others, but some of us are better at covering up our stubbornness than others as well. But we're all pretty stubborn when it comes down to it. I always love it when you see it in practical ways. Two people fighting for the same parking spot. They get there at about the same time, and each one thinks they have an absolute right over that spot. And that the other person deliberately and with malice aforethought planned to take that spot from you, even though they knew very clearly that that was your spot and not their own. And then you can get this Mexican standoff there where they're both sitting there and they're pride. And then it's a matter of who's going to back down. This happens in England all the time on these little B roads, actually C roads. These are roads that are off the aren't even B roads. These are the one track roads, and what they have and they're usually paralleled by these hedgerows, and so you can't get off the road. There's no margin. So what has to happen when you're on a one lane road and you're surrounded by the two hedgerows, that there's these little indentations every maybe 2/10 of a mile, maybe 1/10 of a mile. Guess what that means? One of you has to back up because you're not going to go any further. You see. And there, it's a very interesting deal. Who does the standoff? Theoretically, the person ought to know about where they are relative to that. But I've had experiences like that, and it's a loser's game, really, to do that. You both lose in the process, and then pride gets worse and worse. You see, so better just to back off and humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and let Him exalt you at the proper time. That's an opportunity for your spiritual growth, but that's another thing. Many of us wouldn't like so many opportunities for growth. So the point is that we all turn aside. What then, Paul says in Romans 3. Verses 9 and 10. Are we better than they? Not at all. We've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. There is the answer. All of us, Jew and Greek, Paul says, are under sin, and therefore we all need the same solution. There's none righteous, not even one. And so the solution is to receive this payment that he makes. He says, is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised by faith, is one. So now sometimes people put it this way. Here's the way they say, aren't you nitpicking? After all, Judaism worships the one true God of the Old Testament. Christianity proclaims Christ as the God of the Old Testament and the God of the Old Testament as one. Therefore, Judaism in reality believes in the same God. That's one way of framing it. But let's frame it differently. We could say it this way. Judaism rejects Christ as the Son of God. Christianity, Christ is the Son of God and the only way to the Father. And if that's true, then Judaism in reality has rejected the only way to the Father. You can't have it both ways. You see, the issue is, what are you going to do with this Jesus? Now, the thing I must stress when I share this message is, in all humility, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm just the messenger. And you need to understand that I didn't make this up. I'm proclaiming the message of one who is utterly unique in the annals of history and who had unique credentials to back up his claims. We saw some of his credentials last week. There are numerous ones. The resurrection is not a bad one. That's not bad, you know. His credentials were that he really did fulfill those prophecies. Many, many, many prophecies. And very, very literally and graphically. Very specifically as well. His miracles. Remember he said, if you do not believe on account of the words that I speak, believe on account of the works that I do, these will proclaim that I'm from the Father. Sinlessness. Which of you, again, convicts me of that? These are strong claims. I would be real scared to make such a claim as that. Especially in front of people who know me real well. Especially in front of my wife. I mean, those are strong kinds of claims, and many others as well. And that he could break the power of disease and of death and of demons and had authority even over nature. What man is this that even the wind and the wave obey him? Strong stuff. You don't see any other figure in human history that even comes close to this. The question is, what's the content of that view of God? And the question is also, first of all, what do I mean by God? For many people, in fact, a growing number of people, what they mean by God is not a personal being at all, but an impersonal force. A growing number, very rapidly in the last 20 years. But even so, given that, first of all, and then secondly, how does one enter into a right relationship? If this God is personal, how is it done? To my mind, I only know of two options. One is works, and one is faith in one who has already done the work for us. I can't think of a third option. Maybe you can, but I can't. So I'm suggesting here that now the issue is not just a matter of trusting in Jesus Christ because that's what we're telling you to do, but because that's the only way that God is made available by which our sins can be forgiven. Now, I can think of another way of dealing with the problem of sin. And the only other way I know is works. Only way I know. Now, those works can be defined in a variety of ways. They can be prayers. You pray, you give, you do good works to people, you serve the poor, you give to organizations, you serve your community, you raise a good family, you do these things, you go to church, you're baptized. I'm suggesting that not one of those things in and of themselves cuts it with God. Because they were works. You were trying to do it in your power. And I'm suggesting here that that by itself won't do it. So I'm saying what I have to look at is what did he claim and what are the implications of those claims? And not all who name the name of the Father. This is why he said, many will say, Lord, Lord, and I'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. So there's this issue that I have to deal with here that he himself is making this claim that not all people who are religious know God.
I was going to say, to the Orthodox view, or at least the Orthodox view, you demonstrate your faith by obedience and by control.
Yes, basically, Orthodoxy would say it's obedience to Torah and mitzvot, these good works. And on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, there's the issue of contrition or penance. And so, but basically, the mindset is, how do I get to know God? Well, I have to do these things, and if I do well enough, he'll let me in, or some variation of it. Usually it's not analyzed that far, but usually it's the idea that I'm hoping in my effort to achieve that. Now, we're going to talk about good works later, so I don't want to get into that. But I'm just suggesting here that I have to, it's not up to me to call the rules. In other words, I don't get to name the rules. If Jesus is the decisive revelation of the Father's love and offer of a way of knowing him, then I have to take him seriously. I can say he's wrong, but I cannot say that he's right and then ignore him. I can reject him, but I can't ignore him. I can accept him, I can reject him, but to ignore him is to reject him. That's the problem. People like to say, I just don't want to deal with that. Fine. But you'll deal with it one day. If Jesus is who he claims to be, all will stand before him. And so it's a prudent idea now to deal with that. And that's why I say I try to help people and make a carefully informed decision about him. Yes.
So then what's with Messianic Jews? Are Christians?
I want to say that Messianic Jews are Christians, and so are Gentiles can be Christians. In fact, there are Hebrew Christians and there are Gentile Christians. What I always tell Jewish people is you don't give up your Jewishness by becoming a Christian any more than an Irishman gives up his Irishness by coming to faith in Jesus. You see my point here? You're not giving up anything. In fact, you're gaining something. Actually, what you're doing is you're finally finding the one about whom the Passover was, the Seder was always about him. And you discover that all the feasts were about him. And you discover, in fact, that you're a completed Jew, as some of them use that phrase, because all that the Torah and prophets and writings spoke of are fulfilled in this one person. And that you now realize that what I've been looking for all along has already come. And so instead of giving up, and so I always stress, you don't become a Gentile when you come to Christ. Either you're a Gentile or you're a Jew. Now, you might be a Gentile Christian, or you might be a Gentile non-Christian or unbeliever. You might be a Jewish believer or Jew. There's no difference, in other words. And Paul himself is stressing this issue, that the same God... the same way is available for all. Yes?
Romans 2:14, are you familiar with it?
Well, he talks about the conscience there, and that if they don't have the law, they'll be condemned because those who have the law, though they know the law, they will be judged by the law. But those who do not hear the law, though they have a law within them, again, I'm just saying the language itself is pretty strong stuff. And he says that to those who by perseverance and diligence and so forth, who wish to know God, they're going to come to know him. How that happens is going to ultimately be based on the work of Jesus Christ, which brings us to next week's question, which is the question about what about those who never heard? In other words, are you saying then, because the next obvious question is this, if he is the way and the truth and the life, then what about people who haven't ever heard of him? And furthermore, what about people who never are capable of making a decision? Let's say infants who die. Or let's say people who never reach an age of accountability intellectually, where they're mentally deficient. Or let's say, what about people before Jesus Christ? What about those people? Let's take people in China. Let's take people in South America before any missionaries came. What about them? You with me here? So you have to raise that question because it's the logical implication of it. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. By the way, someone asked me Sunday morning, why did God choose the Jews? And my answer, he didn't choose the Jews. He chose a person, Abram, and made of him a nation. The Jews didn't exist when he chose Abram. He made of Abraham, or Abram at that time, then Abraham, a father of many. So he chose a person who then became and he gave him a covenant. He said, all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. That's Gentiles as well as Jews. And indeed, that's exactly what's happened. So salvation, which came through the Jews, is now available to all. And that's what I think that he's saying there. And those who worship the Father must worship him, he says, in two ways. Spirit and in truth. They go together. The Spirit, the Word of God and the Spirit of God go together. And the power of God and the truth of God must go together. And so worship, true worship is there. By the way, some people say, isn't it rather arrogant of you and unloving and harsh to say that Christ has preached that kind of message? And I suggest, suppose you that you discovered a cure for cancer and felt, you know, I better not share my cure because all these other people have been working so hard to find a cure would really be disturbed because it would show that their research was in fact invalid. You see the problem? But see, if you have a cure, you want to share it. It's not a matter of arrogance. It's a matter of saying, I found something that's changed my life. He can change your life too. I'm not saying I'm a better person than you. In fact, I realize now I'm a whole lot worse than I thought I was. You understand this is true. When you come to Jesus, two things happen here. One thing is that you realize that you're a whole lot worse than you ever thought you were. And number two, you realize God's a whole lot greater than you ever thought he was. And that's why you begin to, that's why you realize works aren't going to cut it. You can't bridge that gap. So, frankly, it's not a matter of arrogance. It's a matter of a person saying, I, myself, I'm the worst person in the sense of, I know what I'm like inside. You don't know that. You know what you're like inside. I'll take it by faith that you have a problem maybe too. But the worst thing we can do is to cover it up and suppose that all is well and that we're just great folks. And I'm suggesting that in our lives, the cure is more radical than that. It's called a heart transplant. And you need a new heart, a new nature. I will quote another thing from another text, and I want you to know this one too. This is a great reference here. It's Mark 7. This had to do with laws of purification. And by the way, more and more, one of the things that's been discovered in the last 30 years in the quest for the historical Jesus and so forth, lots and lots of work has compared the Gospels with Palestinian Judaism, and it's been found to be a more clear understanding of how consistent the Gospels are with first century, Palestinian Judaism. Second Temple Judaism is so perfectly illustrated in this, and it's really a kind of rediscovery of how this fits so well in its context. One of the things that Jesus challenged here was the laws of purification. In Mark chapter 7, he talks about how these people, if we look at this in verse 8, they're more concerned about the traditions of men than the commandments of God. And then he goes on to say that you do many things with your traditions. You're more concerned about your human traditions. When the oral traditions had become like barnacles that encrusted, and finally you couldn't even see the law anymore, the truth. He says, after this he called the crowd to him, and he says, listen to me, and understand, there's nothing outside the man which can defile him, if it goes into him. But the things which proceed out of the man are that which defile the man. When he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples questioned him because they were very bothered by that word, because they all their lives had heard laws of kashrut, the idea of being kosher. And those things, some things are pure and some clean and some things are unclean. What do you mean by that? And he said, are you so lacking in understanding? Do you not understand that whatever goes into the man from the outside cannot defile him, because it does not go into his heart but into his stomach and is eliminated? Thus he declared all foods clean. He was saying that which proceeds out of the mouth is that's what defiles the man. He's saying it's not what you put in, but it's what comes out of your mouth. And he says, for from within. Now here's the verse, Matthew 7:21. This is rather strong stuff here. Jesus' view of human nature is a little different than humanistic psychology, I have to say. For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting, and wickedness. He could have stopped right there, but he goes on to say, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. I think he's got us all. All these things proceed from within and defile the man. Do you see the problem? His analysis of the human condition, then, is that we have an inside problem, not outside. If our problem were external, then clean up your act by doing certain things, and everything's cool. He's saying, you have so externalized the law, you've failed to see the inside. And that's why the Sermon on the Mount says, it's not a question of just murdering your brother, it's a question of hating him. That's like murder. It's because it's not just what you've done, but what you think and your attitude, your heart, which means that it's a lot worse than we thought. That all of us violated the commandments of God. Some of them are more obvious than others. We say, well, I haven't committed adultery, I haven't murdered. Check it again. I'll let you think that through in terms of your thought life. Of course, the one that always gets us is coveting. Anyone says he's never coveted. There's something wrong with their analysis of them. So they have a deficient self-understanding. Let's put it that way. They haven't analyzed them. I'll quit here, and we'll pick up next week. We're going to do this question number 7, the question we alluded to already. Will God judge those who never heard about Christ?
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflections.com.